From Pittsburgh to York, Winbur to Selinsgrove, Grove, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania could be one of the world's leading exporters of energy, but state regulations and policies are holding us back. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation are here for a Capital Watch discussion. And the state's public education cabal is simultaneously touting historically high spending levels while claiming there is a funding crisis. I'll have a town hall commentary on this two-faced approach to education funding. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Although significant races for statewide courts and a wide array of county and local offices are up for election in just a few weeks, 2024 races are taking the spotlight. A group of nearly 100 Republican leaders from across Penn's Woods has sent a letter to David McCormick urging him to challenge U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr., who is running for re-election next year. McCormick lost the Republican U.S. Senate nomination in 2022 to Dr. Mehmet Oz by less than 1,000 votes and is considered to be the strongest potential candidate to take on Casey. For his part, McCormick is acting like a candidate, although he has yet to make a formal announcement, which sources say could come later this month. The race for the Democratic nomination for Pennsylvania Attorney General is getting crowded. State Representative Jared Solomon of Philadelphia announced his candidacy this past week. He joins former State Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, Joe Comm, and Keir Bradford Gray in seeking the post, which will be an open seat, as incumbent Attorney General Michelle Henry is not running. She was appointed to the post to fill the remaining years on Josh Shapiro's term. Shapiro, of course, resigned as Attorney General when he was sworn in as governor earlier this year. On the Republican side, York County District Attorney David Sunday has announced his candidacy for Attorney General. Meanwhile, the date of the 2024 primary election remains up in the air. The primary is scheduled for the last Tuesday in April, but that falls during Passover. There's also a push to hold the primary earlier to give Pennsylvania voters a bigger voice in the presidential nomination process. A state Senate committee has passed a bill moving the primary to March 19th, but similar legislation in the state House proposes other dates. The legislature is set to return at the end of September from a three-month summer recess. It will consider the issue at that time. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. While Pennsylvania sits atop one of the world's largest natural gas reserves, the Commonwealth could be a net exporter of energy in the process, creating thousands of high-paying jobs. For a look at how state policies are preventing this from happening, we turn to our Capital Watch crew. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to be with you.
Thank you, David. It's great to be with you.
Well, and we get quality time.
Quality time today.
Our friend Rebecca, it was just me and her for the last program this time around. You and I are going to kick it around for a while. So one of the exciting things, and the listeners have heard us talk about this a lot, because it really is a critical issue for Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania energy and the potential that Pennsylvania energy has to supercharge our economy, to power our manufacturing sector, to give us the inputs to make stuff. And this all comes from the Marcellus Shale, the natural gas, huge reserves of natural gas, like trillions of cubic feet of natural gas recoverable, and that just this in the very recent past year, that Carl Moreira, PMA's executive director, gave testimony about liquefied natural gas and a potential LNG export terminal in southeastern Pennsylvania.
And when we talk about natural gas, there are several markets involved. Part of that natural gas industry you talked about in Pennsylvania serves consumers, across Pennsylvania and beyond. We've become the number one exporter of electricity, much of which is generated through plants that, utilize natural gas as their fuel to make the electricity. So on one level, there's the American customer,
right,
who is benefiting tremendously from the opportunity that's been provided by the responsible usage of the natural gas found in the Marcellus Shale and other shale formations in Pennsylvania on a scale that still is mind-boggling to anyone who's studied energy's history.
Really is.
You're talking hundreds of years worth of cheap, clean natural gas resources that can drive our economy. So that's happening. That's one market. But then there's the worldwide market.
Mm-hmm.
We know, as we sit here, there's a large amount of, natural gas that, that's turned into liquefied natural gas so it can be shipped that goes around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Giant ocean-going vessels taking it from one country to another. And that's also an important market. And sometimes I've heard folks kind of denigrate the idea of exporting energy as if that was somehow bad or some kind of a ripoff for the home folks.
Right.
But that's not the case.
It's like, no, we get to make money the way the Saudis make money
exactly.
off of us.
That natural gas, and that's what your colleague Carl Marrero was talking about, that natural gas that is exported generates a massive amount of economic activity for Pennsylvanians,
right.
People who are looking for the chance to make a living and live in this Commonwealth and raise their kids here and be able to earn a decent, high-quality lifestyle from the work they do. That's what exporting liquefied natural gas does for us.
And it's a couple of things that I wanted to explain to the listener, Steve. So you know, methane, natural gas, is, as the name said, it's aerated. It's a gas. But when that gas is supercooled, it condenses into a thick liquid. And this is how large volumes of natural gas can be transported in a seafaring tanker. So that's like the key that makes the large volume of transportation possible. But also, you know, again, reminding the listeners that the richest parts of the Marcellus play are in the northern tier, the far northeast along the New York state border, and then in the far southwest, out in, you know, Greene and Washington counties, Beaver County, along the Ohio-West Virginia line. And like, if we did this correctly in Pennsylvania with an LNG export terminal in southeastern PA, somewhere along the Delaware River, it would be Pennsylvania jobs all the way down. Jobs on the well pad harvesting the energy, jobs at the steel mill to make the steel for the pipelines, jobs at the rolling mill to roll the pipe, jobs for our pipeliners to build the infrastructure, jobs at the factory itself to supercool the methane, but then also potentially jobs at the shipyard to build the ships that would carry this Pennsylvania energy to foreign destinations. So the whole, I start losing the words because it's just so huge. It's a whole universe of potential value-added wealth creation with good-paying jobs, with great benefits and retirement and all these sorts of things. It's the exact sort of thing that we would want, hard-hat jobs for working people.
And it's the spillover effect of that economic activity in the sectors you mentioned that also supports all the ancillary parts of the economy.
Right.
The normal things that we say, oh, those are just normal parts of the economy. We'd have them whether we had gas or not. Well, the volume of grocery stores and retail outlets and transportation companies and anyone involved in almost any sort of the financial sector, the real estate sector,
right?
All those things, yes, we would have them without the natural gas jobs and the energy-driven jobs, but that they too are accelerated and expanded by the fact that they've got this core group that's benefiting directly through working in that energy industry that spills over into all the other sectors of our society and makes us a prosperous state.
Yes. Yes. And I'll, you know, again, I'm with the Manufacturers Association that the making stuff is where the value gets added. And so no matter what it is that you're making, you're going through a multi-stage process where you're taking raw materials or component parts to yield a finished good. And so manufacturing has the strongest multiplier effect. It's not just the jobs on the plant floor. It's all the jobs in the supply chain. It's all the jobs in logistics with, you know, forklift jobs and trucking jobs, plus the vendors who help management, you know, with what happens on the plant floor, whether it's HR or payroll or legal or what have you. And so to have value adding manufacturing activities like, you know, turning methane into LNG, like that's manufacturing, that this, you know, could be a true engine of prosperity, the birth of a whole new transformational industry to give people opportunity to create wealth, to build out, you know, the whole middle income part of our economy. And that's before you even get to the national security implications.
The national security implications, the geopolitical implications are key. But for one second, I want to go back to the simple fiscal impact on the state. There's also all the tax revenue that's derived from the activity we just spoke about. That's the kind of financial resource that can keep the Commonwealth competitive with other states and not force us to raise our taxes in a way that is detrimental and causes people to flee the state.
Exactly. So the econometric model that, that PMA Executive Director Carl Moreira conducted said that in a five-year snapshot, that the proposed riverfront location in the city of Chester, which is a brownfield site, it's 100 acres.
And this would be for the LNP export.
The LNG facility.
Export facility.
For the cooling and export facility would support no less than 31,248 jobs, $2.7 billion in labor income earned, $4.3 billion in gross state product, $7.1 billion in total output, and $714 million in tax revenue. I mean, those are enormous numbers.
And think about this. Along with all that, there's the natural gas impact fee that was enacted in Pennsylvania a little over 10 years ago
right now,
essentially a tax on the drillers.
Right.
And it too is generating record amounts of revenue. There's a piece I got from API, it's a group that works with the energy industry, petroleum in particular. And in the last year where the stats are complete, 2022, the natural gas impact fee in Pennsylvania generated a record $279 million for communities across the state. That gets distributed to the local counties where the drilling is taking place, but also to the other counties where there isn't drilling. And so bridges are being built, recreational facilities, emergency facilities, roads are being repaired, infrastructure being fixed because of that.
And a lot of environmental programs.
A lot of environmental funded. Because of that $279 million that was generated from the impact fees alone last year.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation.
And David, we talked about some of the different economic benefits, but what we didn't talk about was the environmental impact of utilizing Pennsylvania natural gas.
Oh, sure.
As either fuel for our own customers that here in the Commonwealth and beyond, but also for overseas export.
Mm-hmm.
When a country, a state, a county, whatever it may be, when electricity production switches over from being fired by coal power plants that mm-hmm. burn coal to generate that electricity, mm-hmm. that turn the turbines and create the electricity and all that, when they switch over to natural gas, It is a massive upgrade in terms of improved impact for the environment.
Right.
We're talking not just the carbon production being lower, but the various other pollutants that are typically attached to fossil fuels and the burning of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Because the natural gas burns so efficiently and the technology is so efficient, there is very little of that wastage that creates those byproducts that are generally considered to be the pollutants, the sulfur oxides and the different things that do damage to the environment. All that has been drastically reduced.
Correct.
Thanks to the replacement of some of the traditional fossil fuel energy sources with natural gas.
It's
but natural gas is, unlike some of the alternative fuels that are often talked about, like wind power and so forth, and solar. That natural gas is reliable, just like coal.
Correct.
It's there. If you need it during a long storm or a long cloudy period, it's still producing the baseload electricity that we need.
Yes. And again, if it's connected by pipeline to the source where it's being, you know, harvested, it's a continuous flow. I want to get to that other, you know, national security sort of dimension, because this is something that I don't think our decision makers in Harrisburg think about to the extent that they even know about it at all. I mean, certainly to the extent that policy in Harrisburg helps with energy production or hurts with energy production, it has an effect on America's output, on the whole, you know, American energy portfolio. And, you know, for the sake of independence, energy independence and our national security, I would say that we would want to maximize domestic energy production. But you look at the situation in Europe, you look at the war with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Well, for many years, that Russia had gained basically gained control of the German economy, in that the German economy is driven by manufacturing, and that they came to rely on very low prices from Russian natural gas. And so now with Putin's invasion, with the outbreak of war, with Germany having to disentangle itself from those relationships with Russia, now Germany's economy is in bad, bad trouble, because its most important sector, manufacturing, is now coping with restrictions on supply and very high prices for supply of energy. And so this is the moment when, you know, as America has done so many times before, that we are poised to rescue our European allies this way through the supply of liquefied natural gas. The current U.S. export terminals, there is one at Cove Point, Maryland, which is actually fueled by Pennsylvania natural gas. It's not especially large, and at this point, it's been built out to full capacity. The larger export terminals are in Texas, and if we're talking about resupplying Europe, Philadelphia is a whole lot closer than Corpus Christi, Texas. And
makes
so
a big difference
for a geostrategic American global leadership view. This is something that we should be doing as we help other friendly countries disentangle themselves from, you know, complicated energy relationships with hostile powers, like whether it's the OPEC powers or whether it's, you know, whether it's Russia. Like, when they start having energy relationships with us, and that we're, you know, that they become our customers and that we're working together, at that point, their security interests also become even more congruent with our own. And so this is a way for us to not only, you know, strengthen ourselves, but also to make our allies more defensible, and again, to have a new and even greater closeness with our traditional allies within NATO and around the world.
And I think when you look at this, we look at the benefits of Pennsylvania energy to the economy, to the environment, to the international stability of our world. Why are we talking about this today? Why are we touting all the important benefits of Pennsylvania energy? Because it's under threat.
Correct.
From bureaucrats, from government red tape, from
fanatics,
environmental fanatics, folks who just don't see the obvious benefits compared to any other alternative, and are actually trying to undermine
yes.
all these good things we've talked
and
about.
And it's, you know, and it's, this is one of the ongoing problems with dealing with these environmental issues, because the fear that people have is very real, even when the danger is not. So trying to have a conversation based on facts and not on irrational fears, it's an ongoing challenge. And that's, you know, part for, you know, for those of us in the productive sector, for those of us who are advocates of domestic energy and energy independence, you know, we have to keep going back to fundamentals and talking, you know, defending things like pipeline, saying pipeline is the safest way to, you know, to transport these large volumes of fuels. And in fact, just as an aside, that the Biden administration had just changed a rule about rail transport to prevent LNG from being transported by rail. So it's like, okay, so you're cutting off pipeline, which would be the safest way. Now you're cutting off rail transport, which is the next safest way. I mean, it's only a matter of time now before they go after, tanker trucks on the roads. It's like we need people to understand these fuels are what sustain our civilization. That these fuels and the industrial inputs from them, that the things that keep us alive, that make our lives clean and safe and sanitary and comfortable and convenient, all those things depend on fossil fuels. Steel, cement, plastics, and ammonia. Those things can't be made without either the components of fossil fuels or the very high temperature point that can only be achieved through furnaces. These things can't be electrified. You can't reach that point of heat to make these things possible. And so it's a fundamental mistake to only look at the small and potential negative effects of using these energy sources as opposed to the massive benefits that these fuels provide, that all of us experience every day, that we've experienced our entire lives to the point where we literally cannot imagine what life would be like without them, even as we don't understand or appreciate that that's how these things become possible.
And it should be self-evident, but because of some of the slanted presentations of the news media and,
yes,
and some of the less than genuine folks who are involved in trying to shut down these energy industries across Pennsylvania and beyond, it's not because they aren't getting the solid information, which is why, again, we wanted to talk about this today.
Yes. So this is an ongoing process. Inevitably, if you folks keep listening, you'll hear us talk about this again and again. But we're grateful for you spending time with us and hearing us out on this show. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org on the web. And I want to commend PMA as well for the fantastic work you do in this same arena.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And as ever, you can find us online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and me, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. In the now famous Lincoln-Douglas debates during the 1858 U.S. Senate election in Illinois, Democratic U.S. Senator Stephen A. Douglas accused his Republican challenger, Abraham Lincoln, of being two-faced, to which Lincoln famously replied, quote, "If I were two-faced, would I show you this one?" Lincoln's famously self-depreciating humor quickly diffused Douglas's attack, accusing Lincoln of standing on two different sides of one issue. During the 2004 presidential campaign, a much less verbally adept U.S. Senator John Kerry found himself the subject of ridicule after he attempted to explain a vote on supplemental appropriation for military operations in Iraq, saying, quote, "I voted for it before I voted against it." Our nation's politics have a rich history of politicians and elected officials trying to pacify both sides of a controversial issue by saying one thing to one group and another thing to a different group. Effectively accomplishing such a fence straddle has become much more difficult in the age of Google and omnipresent cell phones taking video. Such a strategy, however, is being employed by the state's education cabal as it seeks to divert dollars from the public treasury into government-run schools, even those failing the students they claim to serve. This year's John Kerry Award for being for it before being against it goes to Governor Josh Shapiro, who triggered a months-long state budget crisis, still unresolved, by agreeing to fund the Lifeline Scholarship Program, which was mysteriously renamed PASS, but then he line-item vetoed the program after being pressured by special interest groups and House Democrats. But the education funding hypocrisy does not end there. Proponents of ever-increasing funding to K-12 public schools have been two-faced in both crying poor mouth while simultaneously taking credit for the massive increases in such funding that has occurred in recent years. For example, Governor Shapiro's official website touts the, quote, "historic investments in public education, ensuring students have more resources and parents have a voice in their children's education, end quote. The comment touts the $567 million increase in basic education funding for Pennsylvania school districts as the largest basic education funding increase in history. This historic increase in basic education funding followed similar, historically large increases enacting during the 8 years his predecessor, Governor Tom Wolf, was in office. In fact, research conducted by the Commonwealth Foundation reveals state support for public education is, quote, up 54% over the past decade, reaching an all-time high of nearly $15.5 billion in 2023-24. Support for public education is $5,000 per student higher than the national average. The rapid increase in spending has occurred while public school enrollment has dropped 7.7% since 2000. As the Commonwealth Foundation's Nate Benefield said during a recent interview on this program, quote, "We don't have a teacher shortage, we have a student shortage." That many school districts are actually flush with cash is proven by the fact they are stockpiling money in so-called reserve funds. Currently, nearly $6 billion sits in such accounts. While it is prudent to keep some money in reserve, an Auditor General's report last year revealed some school districts are de facto hiding money in reserve funds to justify property tax increases. Despite the ever-increasing flow of spending to educate fewer and fewer students, the education cabal talks out of the other side of its mouth, claiming our public schools are underfunded. In March of this year, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, a powerful special interest group, posted an article on its website headlined, "Call to Action, More Funding to Solve School Staffing Crisis." This statement was made against the backdrop of declining student enrollment and historic levels of funding. So the issue isn't, is there enough money? The real issue is how the money is being spent. Fewer students should require fewer teachers. And the real financial drain is the exponential increase in administrative staff, triggered in part by excessive state reporting requirements. A recent Commonwealth Court ruling declaring the current funding formula for government schools to be unconstitutional is being used by the education cabal to leverage even more state taxpayer dollars. This despite the fact the court did not declare the schools to be underfunded, but found the distribution of those funds to be deficient. So the next raid on the public treasury will come under the guise of complying with that court ruling. The change that must occur, however, is not a funding increase, but rather adjusting the funding formula and requiring school districts to right-size their teaching and administrative staffs to reflect declining student enrollment. With the Town Hall Commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WIOVAM in Reading, WOWYFM in State College, along with WBHVAM in Somerset, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.